Yeah, actually, Les and I go back all the way from the time that I was born. Les has known me for that long. In fact, his father officiated the wedding of my parents a number of years ago. And so Les has been literally, for me, a lifelong friend. And as time has gone on, that relationship has just gotten stronger and stronger, and to really appreciate all that he's done. It's a great privilege for me to be here with you this morning as well. And obviously, the topic of ethics and the Bible is fairly broad. There's an awful lot of things that could be said, and so there's going to be a lot of things that we don't have time to say. I basically want to approach it along these lines. In our world today, there's an awful lot of moral confusion, and I'm quite sure that you are well aware of that. The psalmist in Psalm 119 asked the question, how can a young person keep their way pure? And the answer is by living according to your word. And then just a little bit later, the psalmist says, your word have I hidden in my heart that I might not sin against you. In other words, the word of God is many things, but it is also an ethical guide. It is a guide to proper living. It is a guide to living in purity. And it must be not only understood intellectually, it has to be understood and grasped by who you are in the deepest place. So you take the word of God, you don't just memorize verses, you actually take the word of God and place it deep in your heart so that you do not sin against God. There's an ethical, moral imperative, there's a rationale there that it's not just an intellectual endeavor, it's not just about a religious discipline even, it's about not sinning against God. And really, at some level, a very basic way, the biblical perspective on ethics is that ethics is what we engage in so that we don't sin against God. We don't want to do things that are wrong. We don't want to do things that are immoral. That would be the negative side. The positive side, of course, is that when we keep our way pure, we please God. You know, we love God. We want to honor God. We want to glorify God. And so when it comes to living ethically, we do so to avoid sin and to glorify God. Now, there's tons that can be said about this. What I want to do this morning is just contrast a little bit some secular views of ethics and the biblical foundations for ethics. Sometimes we would call this meta-ethics, that is, providing a big framework in which ethical decisions can actually be made and in which ethical decisions are coherent and make sense. So, a practical issue would be, is abortion morally acceptable? Those are the sorts of things that the Bible takes a definite position on, but we won't be talking about. We're not going to be talking about practical issues. Probably most of us would have widespread agreement on those sorts of things anyway. Although, interestingly enough, probably one of the things that you want to do, if you're thoughtful, is you want to be able to find a way to bring the Bible's ethical positions to bear in society. I'm not sure if you ever have this feeling. I have this feeling all the time that either I'm crazy or the entire rest of the world is crazy. You know, when I look at the media or when I'm online or listen to people talk, I just so often think either I am completely wrong about everything or the whole rest of the world is completely wrong about everything. And there's different metrics for this, and there's different times when this becomes more apparent to me. One was a few months ago. When down in Texas, they had this mass parade and celebration for striking down various restrictions on access to abortion. And I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at all of these people celebrating, and my heart's breaking. And I'm thinking, either all of those people are crazy, or I am. But we both cannot possibly be living in the same reality. We both can't possibly, in a sense, be living in the same universe where this is a cause of celebration to you, and it's a dreadful moral outrage and heartbreaking to me. You can think about other things in our society, other marches and parades that celebrate all kinds of things. And again, you sort of look at that, and you look at the political landscape, and you look at media reporting, and you say, either I'm crazy, or the rest of the world is utterly, morally insane. And actually, believe it or not, that's what it is. Sin is always irrational. You can never actually ever explain sin in a justifying way. It literally never makes sense to sin. It never does. There's no rational explication that will explain sin. And so whenever you have sin, you have something which is by definition irrational. It's a lot more than that, but it's certainly irrational. And so when you celebrate sin, what you are doing is you are entering into a phase or a state of moral insanity. You'll probably remember that last week, if you're paying attention to the news at all, last week there were some judicial rulings that said that doctors in Ontario are going to have to refer for physician-assisted euthanasia. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to perform it themselves, but they need to refer for it. And a lot of medical doctors will say that when they refer something, or when they refer a patient for a treatment, they are endorsing that treatment. In their medical opinion, they are saying, I think this is the right procedure, I don't provide it, but here's someone who will. So it's a crisis of conscience. And the court said, we realize that this actually is a conflict with your freedom of religion, but that's too bad for you. Your religious freedoms will not trump the provision of medical care or even introducing stigma to someone, that if someone wants an abortion, for example, and you indicate that you have a moral problem with that, then now you haven't provided a safe place for them to have their health care. So you need to be able to refer to everything, or you might not be able to practice medicine in Ontario anymore. I know one of our major Ontario universities that has a medical college, there are people on faculty who are already tracking the logic this way, and they've been doing this for months. They've been saying, we believe that doctors should provide absolutely every procedure that is legal in Canada. So if you will not provide abortion services or refer for euthanasia or whatever it is, then you should not be a doctor. But if you shouldn't be a doctor, then why would we waste resources training you at our medical college to become a doctor? So some people are saying there should be a waiver that you need to sign at the beginning of medical college saying that when you graduate, you will provide these services or else we're just wasting our educational resources. I had the opportunity to teach in Cuba about 18 months ago. And one of the pastor's wives had spent 6 years training to be a doctor, and a few months before graduation was expelled from the school without a degree because she either had to take a stand for her Christian views, or she wasn't able to sign something that the government wanted her to sign, or whatever it was. And so she was denied her degree after 6 years of training. And coming back, I remember telling my church that, and we were all horrified. And then today, the writing's on the wall in some ways that Ontario could very well be Cuba, China, Russia. And you don't think that's possible, except that it is somehow. And it's not just the trajectory, it's also the pace of the change. I'm not really all that old. And when I remember what things were like, even when I was growing up in school, to see how different things are today. Seems like either the world is insane or we are. You'll also probably be aware that there have been all kinds of issues about getting government grants for funding various programs and the attestation clause and about reproductive rights and sexual expression and orientation and all of those things that you need to sign saying that you agree with these things, that you're not opposing them, and then all of the kerfuffle of that and all of the rest. I mean, it's a very confusing world, and we are certainly not practicing biblical ethics. So the question, I think, then, for us, if we're being thoughtful, is this. How do we take biblical ethics and apply them in society in any possible way where anyone will hear us? Because we can condemn, and we can send emails to people, or we can write letters to the editor, or we can have coffee shop conversations, but how do we actually have any hope of implementing biblical standards and moral absolutes in our society when our society is so far removed and antithetical from God's word and God's truth? I think one of the things that we need to do, actually, is, you know, we certainly need to know our Bibles well We need to be thoughtful theologically. We need to be careful in terms of ethical formulation. But I think we also need to recognize that for us, when it comes to ethics, we are not in a position of dominant strength. We are actually in a position where we need to tie ethics and apologetics together, because every time we're speaking for biblical moral absolutes, we're on the defensive. And we need to then be able to also defend our positions, defend our views, and even make an argument for our right to come to the table in public discourse, that we shouldn't be marginalized. And if we have a view that happens to also be religious, that doesn't by definition mean that it's illegitimate. And so we need to be people who engage not just with local ethical issues and sort of trade back and forth, I think abortion's wrong and you think it's right. We need to be able to understand our own worldview, defend it, and also deconstruct the worldview of the people in our society. And I think that is actually utterly essential. We need to understand why people in Ontario at this time in history have an ethical view which is so antithetical to the Bible. And if we can do that, then we can actually engage with people on the basis of their ethical principles and foundations. Because if all we're doing is going after the local immediate issue, either same-sex marriage or abortion or welfare or the environment or whatever the local issue is, we're on such totally different pages with everyone else that there's no common ground and we'll be talking past each other. And I'm sure you've noticed this, but no one in society is listening to Christians anymore. No one in society cares a bit about what evangelical Christians say. We are basically condemning the world in our own echo chamber, and no one is paying us any bit of attention at all. And these are issues that are literally matters of life and death. So how do we begin to try to understand sort of the moral confusion, or more properly, what generates the moral confusion in our society when it comes to ethics? Well, there's a lot of things that could be said. I mean, Romans 1 would indicate that all of these issues ultimately stem simply from a rejection of God. And there's no doubt that that's true. People spiral down in depravity and in manifestations of depravity because they don't consider God worth knowing. They know the Creator, and they intentionally suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They intentionally spurn Him. And then they claim to be wise, even though they're fools. And they exchange the glory of God for what God has created. But not only what God has created, it's worse than that. It's the idolatrous images of the things that He's created. And so when you reject God, there is this inevitable downfall, this free fall to increasing levels of moral depravity. But because we hate cognitive dissonance, what we do is we then work as hard as we can to intellectually justify our behavior. So now what you have is you have rebellion against God, which people are doing everything they can to rationalize away. They're doing everything they can to justify from in an intellectual perspective, but it's not, in the first instance, it's not an intellectual problem, it's an emotional, spiritual problem. It's a heart issue, and then the heart sort of drags the brain along behind it. So how is our society then trying to justify intellectual rebellion against God? How is our society trying to justify and claim that immoral things are moral? This is one of those, actually, just off to the side, this is one of the scariest condemnations you get in the prophets, is that when God sends the prophet to say, "Woe to my people, they call black white and white black. They call darkness light and light darkness. They call bitter sweet and sweet bitter." When you get the total inversion of standards, when you get the total inversion of moral principles, you're hopeless. I mean, what do you do when you call morality immoral? What do you do when you call immorality moral? I mean, there's such an incredible amount of dysfunction and confusion there. How do you even begin to sort it out? Your criteria are completely backwards. You literally call right wrong and wrong right. Well, how do we get to that place? Some of you will remember the buzzword, and you can help me out. You can actually raise your hand. It'd be very helpful for me if you've heard this term before. How many of you remember sort of the buzzword and the ethical training that was going on under the name values clarification? Remember values clarification? This is these things were taught at school. I remember this. Maybe that's why most of you don't. You know, I remember this when I was in school, in elementary school, just a wee little kid. And one day, we had this exercise called values clarification, and it was called the lifeboat game. And everyone loves games. How many of you, remember you play the lifeboat game? Like, I won't ask you, like, in real life, but just sort of in theory. And the idea is this. You have a lifeboat. Ship sinks. Tragic. You have a lifeboat. But there's only enough resources for half the number of people in the lifeboat. And so you need to figure out who you're going to pitch overboard, who you're going to kill by throwing overboard to drown. And you know, the worst one, obviously, now, and I still remember this, obviously, there was this sort of old, in our lifeboat game, there was this old diabetic pastor without insulin, right? And so, like, of course that guy's going over. You know, he has no hope. So, you know, get rid of the diabetic pastor. You know, he's the first one who goes over. And you're trying to determine, who do you actually value? Whose life has most meaning? And it's all sort of utilitarian. And the whole idea there really was, instead of clarifying values, the lesson was, you might have thrown out different people, and that's okay. Because when we're clarifying our values, what we're clarifying is that it's your values. It's not my values. You know, if you want to make the wrong choice and keep the diabetic pastor, that's up to you. That's strange, but you can. You know, if you want to throw out this person, that's fine. You want to throw out that person, that's okay. And the whole idea is what you want to do is fine. Clarify your own values. Right? Now, one of the amazing things about that is it's obviously entirely relativistic. So we're not actually working from standards of right and wrong. We're working from standards of your own opinion, your own emotion, your own feeling. And you can't adjudicate those kinds of things. There's no rational discourse. There's no possibility of saying, here are ethical principles and foundations. Maybe there actually are right and wrong things to do. It's merely a matter of, as Protagoras said, man is the measure. Whatever you think is the measure of truth. There's no capital T truth. There's just lots of little truths. And whatever your private view is, that's entirely fine. Just be ethical the way you want. What's interesting about that is that if you pay attention to our society, that's exactly what's being said until you disagree with media-driven morality. All of a sudden, then there are absolutes. All of a sudden, it's values clarification. This is, now I don't like when Christians sort of, you know, hand-wring and have sort of a woe is me, we're all martyrs kind of, you know, mentality. But sort of the idea really is that values are relative unless they're Christian. Like, unless they're evangelical. And then if they are, you're a bigot. You know, how dare you say that? How dare you say that a woman doesn't have a right to an abortion? How dare you say that? Who do you think you are? How dare you say that marriage is for a man and a woman? How dare you say that? You're a bigot. You're homophobic. And you want to say in response, wait a minute, I was taught in elementary school that we could throw anyone under the boat we wanted to. Like, what are you talking about? How can I be a bigot when it's just my values? Like, we just have different value systems. And so what you find is our world, or our society, is very authoritarian with selected issues. But then they're completely relativistic with other ones. Well, who determines that? It's not the Christians. We're the ones who, whatever we bring to the table, are immediately marginalized. We're pushed to the periphery. And so we just need to, even that, I think, is worth pointing out to people sometimes. Some of these discussions say, wait a minute. How is it that you can go, as we're discussing these things, you know, within 2 minutes, you can go from being authoritarian on this issue and an absolutist on this issue, but then a relativist on this issue? What grounds you? What allows you to cherry pick that way? Because it's completely inconsistent and it's unfair. Now, there are other exercises that people do as well, and some of these are legitimate in terms of working through moral principles. Some scenarios, you know, okay, hard cases, test cases, thought experiments can really make you work through in terms of what you think about morality and can generate some clarity on principles. And for example, in church, we can ask people, Do you believe it's okay to lie? And if I did that, I won't right now. But if I said, is it okay to lie? How many of you say no? Probably most of you would put up your hands, right? Say, okay, well, is it okay to lie in any circumstances whatsoever? And probably most people would go, no. You go, oh, really? Well, what if you're hiding Jews in the Second World War and the Nazis knock on your door? And everybody says, okay, there are some exceptions. I mean, that's usually how it goes, right? I mean, like, and you go, okay, well, why? And there's always some people, but I'm not saying this is wrong, but there are always some people who go, no, I'm sticking with what I said first. You know, it's always wrong no matter what. Ten Commandments, do not lie. I'm sticking on that and no matter what. But a lot of people say, no, it is okay in those circumstances. And then the question is why? Are you just a relativist? Are you just someone, I realize this is kind of dated now, but are you someone who's just sort of like Joseph Fletcher falling into situation ethics? And you know, is that what we're saying? Or is there a deeper hierarchy in the Bible where there are absolute morals, but those absolute morals are arranged in a hierarchical pattern? There's different ways of coming out saying it's okay to lie in certain circumstances. To say that that person isn't owed the truth. That it's a violation of the nature of truth to give them the right answer, knowing how they'll abuse it and misuse it. Or to say that in a state of war, deception is acceptable. If you're allowed to, you know, it'd be awfully strange to say you can't lie to that person, but given that it's a state of war, you can kill them. Right? I mean, that is somewhat odd ethically for most people to think that you can justify taking that person's life as long as you're telling them the truth. Yes, there are Jews here. I'm just going to grab the gun. You know, that is a little odd for most people to consider. So in a state of war, is there deception? Yes. There's killing? Yes. Can you deceive without killing? Most people would probably say yes. So there's a whole bunch of ways of working that through. When done poorly, though, that becomes just another way of saying, oh, look, there's no real morality out there. It's just all contingent on your own personal view and circumstances at the time. But there's no real moral absolutes. And these are the sorts of things that are done in university classes all the time. So, and younger, I played the lifeboat game in elementary school. You come along and you say, well, what about stealing? Is stealing always wrong? Stealing's always wrong. Okay, well, what if a refugee family in Sudan is fleeing for their lives and they end up in your home and you've just eaten the last bit of your food, you're basically starving too, and your neighbor is an exploitative, oppressive cash crop farmer who's just about to harvest his many, 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 many fields filled with food, and you go over and you knock on his door and you say, listen, this family's about to starve to death. Can I give them something to eat? I don't have any food. Can I borrow some? Can I take some of your crops? And he says, no. Later that night, as your refugee family, and we'll say they all have malaria or something, you know, and they're just in desperate states, do you have the right to sneak over into your neighbor's field and take a couple cucumbers and come back and feed this family so they don't starve to death? A lot of people are going to say yes. Okay, so now stealing's okay in certain circumstances, right? How many of you believe that killing an innocent person is wrong all the time? Oh yeah, that's wrong. Well, you know, we can go through scenarios about that too. So there's all kinds of things, and people are just trying to basically say ethics are just this, it's this relativistic mess. There's absolutely no true morals. There's, you know, we do the best we can, but ethics is a bit of a myth. It's all relativistic. Now, just so you know, there's at the church where I'm at, I have a friend who's an Air Canada pilot, and you know, we've discussed that he, as a pilot, has a code that if the plane is taken over by terrorists, he sends this code and military jets come and shoot them down. 451 innocent people on board. Do you justify killing 451 innocent people on board to stop whatever terrorist activity is going on? If you say yes, then it would seem that in some circumstances you are okay with the killing of innocent people, right? And you could go on and on and on and on. They're programming driverless cars. Part of programming driverless cars is deciding which people do you run into if someone steps in front of you and all of a sudden there's a crowd in an intersection. Which way does the satellite? You have to program that in. Most of us say, well, you run into the fewest number of people possible. Right. Believe me, if they can get technical enough where they can program the car to run into pastors, that's what they're going to do. But you know, but probably most of us are going quantity. Like it's a quantitative decision, right? Sure. You say, well, what if you're a train engineer and you're driving down the tracks and you know down this way there's five people and you can turn onto this track and there's one person. Well, where do you go? Well, you probably turn the wheel and you kill that innocent person. Better to save five lives than kill one. But what if it's two versus one? Well, you still probably make that decision. But what if you're driving down, you're running your train down the tracks and you see two people dressed in their prison orange who are part of a work program cleaning up the tracks, and there's a five-year-old child over here. Still 2-1. How many of you hit the convicts? Don't raise your hand, right? But the whole point, again, is just sort of, oh, let's just throw all this out. Let's just throw all of this out without any sort of actual moral foundation or standard. Just think it through. Whatever you come up with is okay. And the whole thrust of it all, instead of actually saying, some of these thought experiments can clarify principle if you're working from a foundation. You start with a foundation and work your way out to the periphery. In jurisprudence, there's a legal principle, hard cases make bad laws. But that's exactly how what we do with ethics, is we usually start with the hard, and in some ways, you know, I mean, theoretically possible, but probably most of us are not going to be driving a train making that decision one day, right? So we're starting with scenarios that are completely detached from our own real-life experience, saying, make an ethical decision, and that becomes your binding principle. Instead of saying, wait a minute, how has God done these things? God has revealed to us in sequence ethical foundations and priorities, which are normative and general, which then you can begin to adduce principles from that you can apply in difficult situations. But God doesn't start in Genesis 1 by saying, now I want you to consider the morality of killing five versus one. Or what if someone's starving to death? That's not part of the Ten Commandments, right? And so what you do is God builds up a category of general, consistent moral principles and revelation so that you don't sin against him, so you can bring him glory, and then he sort of works out. So are there very difficult things that take place in our world? Are there actual moral and ethical dilemmas? Yes, because of sin. In the new heavens and new earth, there will not be one single moral or ethical dilemma. Because when there isn't sin, you don't have to make decisions which are less than ideal. There's nothing wrong with God's revelation and God's moral character. There's something wrong with us. There's something wrong with our hearts, and there's something wrong with the world environment that we're cultivating. So what we need to do is we need to come back to Scripture and work through it sort of sequentially, laying major ethical foundation blocks, and then insisting that those things actually are foundational, that they're absolute, that they are immovable. And then we try the best we can, perhaps in the hardest possible cases, to see how these principles extend and apply. But we don't go to the periphery to try to destroy the center. And that's an incredibly significant difference. In a lot of ethical teaching, what people are doing is they're going to the hardest possible cases where our ethical intuitions kind of break down a little bit. And if we're honest, sometimes we go, I don't know what I'd do. Or I think I'd do this, but I'm not sure I can justify that. That's just tough. That's really hard. You don't start with the things that are really hard to then say, well, then there's no center. You start with the center and then start working your way out. Our society has raised an entire generation of people who have had their ethical training completely inverted. Then they've been told that it's all relative. And then they've been brainwashed to think that you can't even speak against certain positions that our government and media take for granted. So what you have is actually an ethical situation in Ontario which is completely and utterly unsustainable because it's internally incoherent. Secular ethics are completely incoherent in our society. And that's why when you ask the question, am I crazy or is it the rest of the world? Well, it might be both, but it is definitely the rest of the world. The rest of the world is ethically insane. There are no foundations, and there aren't even any actual principles that are sustainable and coherent. Now, you can push this, actually, sort of at a larger macro level, too. So you can come alongside of people, and moving from sort of the local practical issue, whatever that may be, you can ask people, you can challenge people as to what their ethical framework is. That is, how does your worldview stay connected in such a way that ethics are even theoretically possible? For example, there are a wide variety of ways that theorists and philosophers break down the concept of a worldview. James Sire asks 8 worldview questions. There's a bunch of different ways of doing this. I think one very helpful way is to sort of isolate 5 key worldview planks or foundation blocks. One would be theology or a view of God. If you're an atheist or an evangelical Christian, your view of the universe is going to be radically different from the very beginning. Now, you can start breaking that down even further. So there's a massive difference between believing in a triune God and believing in Allah. There's a massive difference between believing in a personal God and believing in sort of the deities of Hinduism. So there are all kinds of different ways of differentiating even inside of theism. But roughly, your view of theology will have a huge difference on your view of the universe, which brings up the universe. The second big plank would be the universe, or reality, or metaphysics, or ontology. What is stuff? Like, what is this world? Where did it come from? Is there any purpose for it at all? Your view of the world is very different if you believe that the world is a special creation of God, or if you believe that the world quite literally came into existence out of nothing, which actually is impossible also, just to throw that in. But if there's no purpose for the universe, if it just is, that's very different than if it's intentionally created. That will obviously affect your view of human beings. So sort of the third major block is anthropology, or the nature of humanity. What are we? Is there any purpose to our existence? Are we cosmic orphans, adrift in this universe without anyone who cares for us? Are we merely the concatenations of atoms, the accidental production of matter in motion given time and chance? Is that really what we are? Or are we the image bearers of God? At death, do our bodies just dissolve atomically? Or do we have an eternal spirit that goes to be with the Lord? Like, your view of human beings all of a sudden is pretty different depending on which way you land. Then you'd have a view of knowledge, epistemology. How do we know things? What are proper procedures for determining truth? What are reliable mechanisms for understanding and growing in knowledge, etc., etc.? And then ethics. Is there right and wrong? What's the standard? What's the standard and status of morality in our world? Now, what you need, ideally and ultimately, is you need consistency and coherence between all 5 of those things. Now, this is pretty obvious. You are a really, really terrible atheist if your view of theology is that there is no God and your view of human beings is that human beings were created in the image of God, right? Like, you're a really bad atheist if you can't keep that straight. So what you're looking for is you're looking for consistency and coherence. I would argue, if I had great length, I would argue that secular humanism entirely breaks down into incoherence because there you can't sustain a rational coherence between atheism, the existence of the world, human nature, human knowledge, and ethics. Where do ethics come from in a situation like that? One of the really difficult things with it is that if the universe exists for no reason, if it's merely matter and energy in motion over time, then what you end up with is a situation in which morality is literally non-existent at the beginning of the universe. It's not there. Morality is not part of the deep structure of reality. It's not embedded in the fabric of reality. And so at some point, it self-creates, or it emerges. But if it emerges, it can only emerge and sit lightly on the surface of things, because it's not part of the deep structure. It's not part of reality from the very beginning. Now, how can it emerge? I would suggest it can't, for one, but let's sort of say that it did somehow. How does it emerge? Well, if it emerges, it has to emerge from purely natural causation. So eventually, matter in motion, in collision, in chemical interaction, eventually becomes, one, self-conscious. Now, this is all an oversimplification. I grant this. I understand this. But you do realize that at some level, the story is basically this. Matter kept colliding and then self-organized, and eventually this little bit of matter on a Tuesday afternoon said, oh my goodness, I'm not that. Like there's an internal differentiation where all of a sudden matter and motion said, oh, look at me, I'm a subject, and I'm not that object. How interesting. You know, so self-consciousness just sometime emerges. Now, it's supposed to be, you know, it's a lot slower than that. It didn't originally have language and all the rest. But that's basically the idea, that somehow matter in motion, non-sentient, non-intelligent matter, became intelligent. How? How is that possible? And the reality is, if you listen to atheists long enough and carefully enough, they will say this. We have no idea. But it had to happen, because clearly we know that there's a tie between brain function and cognition. And so if there's cognition tied to brain function, at some point, the structure of the brain must have produced self-consciousness. But Sam Harris, you know, the most vocal of the now old new atheists, you know, he would say, he had his PhD in neuroscience from UCLA. And so when he talked about neuroscience, it was actually the only thing he knew about. I mean, he would write about religion, didn't know very much about that. But when he would actually speak about neuroscience, he knew what he was talking about. And he said this in a footnote in one of his books, because he didn't want to call attention to it too carefully. He said, the problem of consciousness, that is how human beings became conscious, the hard problem of consciousness is so intractable that we not only do we not know how it happened, we don't even know how it could have happened. In other words, when we study at the molecular level, it actually seems impossible that brains think, right? So you have to have self-consciousness somehow. So self-consciousness is an emergent property. Then self-consciousness creates intention, and intention is required for ethics. So if a comet hurtles towards the Earth and hits the Earth and destroys it, we don't say that the comet acted immorally. Why? No intention. No cognition. No control. And so the argument would be, to have genuine morality and ethics, what you need self-consciousness, intention, and control. Now, interestingly enough, you can make a really good philosophical argument that given those criteria, human beings are once again amoral with no ethical control whatsoever. And the reason is this. There are a number of philosophers who deal with free will and determinism who are arguing today that if natural law controls behavior, then we are not responsible for what we do. And they're 100% right. So if your brain activity produces intention, and your intention causes you to act, but you didn't control the molecular structure of your brain in the first place, then you're not responsible for what your brain produces, and you're not responsible for what you do. Your behavior in life is entirely determined on the basis of natural law, and control is an illusion that you labor under. And so a lot of philosophers are saying, listen, if we're going to be consistent with atheism, what we need to do is recognize there is no morality at all. Good atheist philosophers have been saying that for centuries. But we also have to stop treating people as if they're responsible. But interestingly enough, Bruce Waller, Saul Smolansky, some of these other actual philosophers who deal with free will and determinism, they're saying that our entire judicial system is outrageous because nobody is responsible for what they do, and we know it. But we're still treating people as if they're responsible. One of the most fascinating comments that Saul Smolansky, this philosopher, makes, the hubris is astounding in this statement, but also the insight is very rare and refreshing. He basically says, so we all know that we're actually not responsible for what we do, and we shouldn't be treated as if we are. So criminals should not be actually punished for what they do because they're not responsible. He says, but don't tell anyone. Because if people knew that, they just run around like they're crazy. So what we need is we need to labor under this, we need to keep this sort of noble lie going in our society that you're responsible and treat people as if they are. Because if we don't, we know that human beings will actually just run around doing whatever they want and all of society will be destroyed. Which is an interesting statement about total depravity. People actually do believe in it. They know it's true. It's inescapable. And then he says this. This is the hubris part. He says, but just don't tell anyone. We're philosophers, so we can know these kinds of things. Good things regular people will, good thing a regular person won't read a book like this. You know, that's sort of the idea. Is it'll just be this little trade secret. We'll just kind of squirrel away and we know we're not responsible, but don't let anyone else know, or else the masses will eat us for breakfast. You know, is sort of the idea there. But given atheism, how are we actually responsible for what we do? That's the point. And it would seem that we're not. We are products of forces beyond our control. Richard Dawkins says we dance to our DNA. Our brain states are just whatever our brain state is. It's produced from the brain state before and back and back and back and back and back. So whatever you're thinking now, you literally could not help think. There was no possibility you would ever be doing anything else other than what you're doing right now. Which probably is a reasonably depressing thought, in your mind. This was always going to be what you were doing on this Saturday morning, listening to me right now. No hope of anything better. So you look at that and you say, okay, well, if I'm not responsible for what I do, then I also can't control what I think. And this is where you get sort of the utter destruction, the internal self-destruction of atheism. Given atheism, you actually can't help think what you think. It's determined by non-sentient molecular motion. But if you can't help what you think, you have no reason to believe that your thinking is reliable. And if you have no reason to think that your thinking is reliable, you have absolutely no reason whatsoever to believe that your view of, say, the existence of God is credible. But if that's the case, then you have no business being an atheist. You actually have an internal system which destroys your own ability epistemologically to know anything reliably, which means you can't know that there is no God. You can't know that given your own worldview. And if you can't know that, then you also can't know anything about ethics. You can't know what's right and wrong. You have no foundation for knowledge which destroys everything else in the worldview. It's a system which actually sets up internal contradictions, which levels the system. It destroys it. And so you can't actually, in some ways, you can't be a thoughtful atheist and be an atheist. Because atheism is a philosophical position, and you can't hold philosophical positions given your own epistemological foundations. And you certainly can't tell me that there is no God, and that God doesn't have a good moral character, that he reveals in his word,
where he provides us with ethical foundations for living. You certainly can't tell me that your view of this ethical situation is right and mine is wrong. What foundation do you stand on to make those moral claims? Now listen, that's all very, very, very quick and very oversimplified and in some ways even caricatured. And it's not fair. It's always wrong to sort of just set up a little straw man and knock it down so you can feel good about yourself. So there's a lot more nuance. There's a lot more complexity. I grant that. I am aware of that. But I think even with levels of complexity, there are times when things don't need to be all that complicated. Like there are other times when we can say, wait a minute, you know, there's hours of argumentation behind this, but when it comes right down to it, this is about where you end up. Let's recover some kind of common sense too when it comes to thinking through some of these issues. So this is basically where you're going to end up. You can come out then and you can start saying to people as you have conversations, not just, you know, abortion is terrible, how can you think that? Or marriage is between a man and a woman. You can say, okay, you know what? I'm interested in your view. You think that women have a right to an abortion? Okay. What do you mean by rights? Where do rights come from? And without being silly, what is a woman? What type of creature is a woman? What type of creature are human beings? What do you mean by human rights? What differentiates us from animals? What differentiates us from trees? What are we? And we can't actually know what we are until we have an understanding of what the universe, the story of the universe is. How do we know these things? And so I think too often in our society, we've just assumed Christianity is guilty until proven innocent with impossible standards of evidence. And in our Ontario society, secular humanism has just been by fiat declared to be innocent and unchallengeable. But there's no reason to have ethical conversations where those are the ground rules. With friends and with other people, we need to get a lot better at saying, no, wait a minute. By the time we get to making ethical and moral claims, we need to be standing on some type of solid foundation which makes moral claims intelligible in the first place. So let's stop bickering, because if all we're going to do is bicker about these issues, we're never going to listen to each other, we're just going to get mad. So let's shelve the local issue for a moment. We'll come back to it. But let's come back to it after we've worked carefully through some of these foundational issues, so you can tell me, and then I'll tell you, where we get our moral views from. Now, very quickly, from a Christian perspective, obviously, God is the standard of moral goodness, intrinsically. He does not sort of bow down to an external moral standard. There's not a third standard out there that God and us are beholding to. So morality actually flows out of the internal goodness and character of God. John Frame has a very, very helpful analysis at this point where he says, morality and ethics actually only exist in terms of personal relationships. So you don't have morality where you don't have persons. You just don't. Those two chairs have no ethical responsibility towards one another. Only in personal context do you have ethical responsibility and obligation. But there are also absolute obligations. That is, when it comes to ethics, we really have this intuition that ethics trumps feelings. And this is extraordinarily important. In fact, some of the ways that you can know that you're dealing with ethics is when what you want to do is something you know you shouldn't. And I think we need to be honest about that. This is where temptation comes in too. We know that oftentimes what we want to do is not the right thing. And so emotions cannot be equated with ethics. They just can't. Because ethics deals with when what we ought to do rather than what we want to do. Right. So as Christians, we say, ethics takes place in personal context and there are absolute obligations. John Frame very astutely says, but if ethics only takes place in personal context and they're absolute, then the only way ethics can actually be coherently grounded is if morality comes from an absolute and personal being. And those are the sorts of things that I read, and I think, how stupid I must be not to have thought of that myself. You know, like, that makes so much sense, that if you're going to have a universe where there is genuine morality in the deepest structures of things, you need an absolute source, and you need a personal source, and they need to be the same. An absolute personal being is absolutely required for universal binding morality. And then Frame will argue, I think you can make a good argument for this as well, rightly, that you actually only get a genuinely personal and absolute being in one place, and that's in the Bible. The God who reveals the Word, the triune God, is absolute and personal. And so because of his existence, his creative work, his design of our nature, and his revelation and character, we actually have a foundation for ethics. So the Bible then not only speaks to local ethical issues, it gives us a worldview foundation on which ethics makes sense. And the world doesn't have that. I think at this point in history, that's probably where we need to engage the world more. Because as I said, when it comes to local issues, you've already figured this out, no one's listening. And no one's going to listen until we can show that actually there's something fundamentally wrong with the secular approach to these things, and there's something sound and coherent with the Christian one. All right, that's, I don't really have a conclusion, so I'm going to stop. Let's go, I'm not sure what's supposed to happen now. Come on up.